from Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles. This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, the 10th of April, 2009. Tens of thousands of Georgians rally in front of Parliament, demanding President Saakashvili immediately step down.
I think that it will take a week, not a more, for Saakashvili to decide whether he goes or he leaves and offered us some solution of this problem.
We'll go to Berkeley, where some parents say a new plan to monitor air quality near schools won't necessarily protect their kids from toxic air.
We place schools near industrial zones, near Superfund sites, near known toxic hazards, and we don't protect our children by simply monitoring the air to ensure what they're breathing is safe.
And the Pentagon's plan to stop building F-22s has lawmakers fighting to protect jobs in their districts. I'm Aura Bogado. Those stories, plus early results from Indonesia's national elections, that's after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. In Fiji today, President Ratu Josefa Iloilo threw out the constitution, fired the island nation's judiciary, and took complete control of the government. Iloilo plans to name an interim government and says the country will hold elections by 2014. Soon after nullifying the constitution, he issued public emergency regulations that ban public gatherings and impose curfews. Iloilo assured local media that basic human rights would be maintained. Today's move comes after a Fijian court invalidated the president's former interim government, which had been in place since 2006. Protesters in Thailand today blocked the entrance to the Asia Summit, a meeting of 16 regional nations that will run through the weekend. Video footage shows protesters crowding the entrance and attempting to turn over police vehicles. The red shirts are backers of former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra. The incumbent president of Algeria has won a third term in office in elections that closed last night. Officials say Abdelaziz Bouteflika won over 90% of the vote, but the election was not without incident. The North African country was rocked by rioting in the capital, Algiers, and one polling station was bombed, injuring two people. The local paper El Watan reports other polling stations were burned as well. Some opposition parties in the country boycotted and are calling the election a charade. New developments today in the deportation case of Ukrainian-born Clevelander John Demjanjuk. Evan Davis has the details.
A federal immigration appeals board ruled today in the case of suspected Nazi death camp guard John Demjanjuk, once again clearing the way for his deportation to Germany to face indictments of charges of war crimes. Demjanjuk, an 89-year-old retired auto worker, was convicted in an Israeli court in 1988. The court said he participated in the executions of some 29,000 Jews and others in the notorious Sobibor concentration camp during World War II. But that conviction was overturned on appeal, and Demjanjuk returned to the U.S. in 1993. The U.S. Justice Department revoked Demjanjuk's citizenship in 2002, citing additional evidence, but he has remained in the U.S. ever since, pending a series of appeals. Because of his advanced age, some are calling the deportation of Demjanjuk a form of torture, but the immigration court has not yet ruled on that issue. Demjanjuk's son, John Jr., said his father intends to appeal today's ruling to a U.S. district court. Evan Davis, Free Speech Radio News.
CIA Director Leon Panetta says the agency has fired security contractors in charge of CIA prisons abroad. He also says he has banned the use of contract interrogators at the facilities. He claimed the CIA's secret prisons have been closed. After a five-year delay, a judge in New York's Southern District Court ruled a human rights lawsuit can move forward to hold multinational corporations liable for their role in South Africa's apartheid. Rebecca Miles from Pacifica Station WBAI in New York has been following the story.
The lawsuit, Encebesa et al. Versus Daimler AG et al., has now the green light to proceed to trial. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of tens of thousands of South Africans and alleges corporations General Motors, Ford, Daimler and IBM aided and abetted South African forces in killings, torture, denationalisation and the crime of apartheid. The complaint against the car companies claims they provided South African forces with armoured military vehicles which went into townships on killing sprees. Tyler Giannini is one of the attorneys representing the plaintiffs. He says IBM provided race-based identity documents that stripped black South Africans of their nationality and citizenship.
IBM was helping to facilitate the production of those documents by providing software. And we're talking about the 1970s, so we're not talking about something you just buy off the shelf. It's got to be customized and supported, and IBM was doing that.
The initial lawsuit included more than 50 companies, but after years of litigation, only a handful remain accused. And because the lawsuit is an alien tort claim, plaintiffs can only seek civil damages. No criminal charges can be brought. Rebecca Miles, Free Speech Radio News, New York.
And finally, the public interest journalism website ProPublica is sifting through the financial disclosure forms of President Barack Obama and nearly 180 other staffers. Because of the sheer volume of the documents, they are seeking help from the community to identify any notable entries. Anyone interested in weighing in should go to ProPublica.org. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
Demonstrators calling for the ouster of Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili have entered their second day of protest, and the political opposition is pledging civil disobedience until the president steps down. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from the capital city of Tbilisi, where protests have so far remained peaceful as tens of thousands of demonstrators continue to rally in front of the nation's parliament.
More than a dozen opposition parties committed to forcing President Saakashvili from power chose the 20th anniversary of a bloody crackdown by Soviet troops to launch their protests. Revez Sokadze was only 10 years old, but said he remembers those dark times.
The people of Georgia at that time, their main demand was to independent. And so Russian troops destroyed the peaceful demonstration, and 20 Georgians died in that process.
Sokadze is part of an underground campaign that's been plastering the city with stickers bearing Saakashvili's face and the words Ratom, why? Opponents have been lampooning the sitting president, who's seen his popularity plummet since he came to power after the people-driven Rose Revolution of 2003. On April 9th, about 50,000 turned out to gather in front of the parliament. One of the main streets of Tbilisi shut down while opposition leaders made speeches imploring the president to call new elections. Both the opposition leaders and the government have pledged not to incite violence. In late 2007, riot police used tear gas and rubber bullets to disperse thousands of anti-Saakashvili demonstrators, and both sides say they don't want a repeat of the past. Deputy Interior Minister Eka Zugulaci told reporters that the government will tolerate demonstrators as long as they remain peaceful.
Georgian democracy was ready for this demonstration. And it also means that we are a progressive democracy, a working democracy. The fact that the demonstration is peaceful and the fact that the police manages its objectives also in a non-violent manner means that we are learning from our past experiences and going forward, not backward.
Sasa Pipia, a 19-year-old, said demonstrators are preparing for the long haul.
I think that it will take a week, not a more, for Saakashvili to decide whether he goes or he leaves and offered us some solution of this problem.
Like many in the crowd, Pipia criticized the president's handling of last summer's war with Russia and the state of the economy. On Friday, the president told the International Press Corps that his term runs until 2013 and said he's not resigning. Instead, he repeated his call for talks with his political opponents.
I want to again reiterate our offer of a dialogue on strengthening our democratic institutions, and I want to say that we mean it. This offer is real, this is profound, this is substantial, and I'm sure this is going to produce real results.
At Friday's rally, opposition leaders rejected the president's offer and pledged to step up their campaign of civil disobedience by blocking important arteries in the capital city. The Interior Ministry responded by saying their strategy of restraint will remain for the time being. Thousands of people continue to hold vigil in front of the parliament, but so far the atmosphere remains calm in this capital city. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Tbilisi.
first official counts from Indonesia's national elections began trickling in Friday night local time in the capital city of Jakarta. A quick count confirms what pre-election polls predicted. President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono's Democratic Party appears to have garnered around 20% of the seats in parliament. That's nearly three times what the party got in 2004's elections. This marks the country's third national election since the fall of dictator Suharto in 1998. And it's likely Yudhoyono's eight-year-old party is the only one to come close to meeting the 25% quota needed to nominate a candidate in July's presidential elections, Belinda Lopez reports from Jakarta.
170 million Indonesians were eligible to vote in Indonesia's second direct election since the Suharto dictatorship fell in 1998. Early polling showed Yudhoyono's Democratic Party well ahead of its nearest competitors, the former leading Golkar Party and former President Megawati's Democratic Party of Struggle. Dr. Dewi Fortuna Anwar is a former Secretary of State for Foreign Affairs and is now Senior Professor at the Indonesian Institute of Sciences.
His party must be celebrating because it seems to be doing pretty well and, I suppose probably better than they really expected. And now with Democratic Party getting some 20% of the vote, it is in a much more privileged position to call the shot and to pick and choose.
Indonesia's currency, the rupiah, gained earlier this week on speculation that Yudhoyono's party could more than double its seats in parliament and therefore have more freedom to pursue economic stimulus policies that have been blocked by coalition partners. In the shadow of the global crisis, economic performance, job security and everyday concerns appear to be firmly in the forefront of Indonesians' minds these elections, with Islamic parties in the country scoring their worst results ever.
The more moderate secular nationalist parties seems to be doing pretty well in the top three, garnering up to 60% of the vote. So altogether, the Islamist parties and the more Islamic-oriented parties will probably only get about the maximum 20% of the total vote.
There were problems at polls. Reports poured in from around the country of incorrect or absent names or individuals being listed twice on voter lists. Incorrectly distributed poll ballots were also widely reported, with at last count 205 incidents of election violations. Despite allegations of voter list manipulation in a recent provincial election, Anwar said she believed the current election irregularities were administrative problems.
I don't see that as being done deliberately in order to do gerrymandering. I think this is more of a technical problem rather than a political thing. But we really need to improve our national database with maybe a single number for each citizen so that everybody knows who everybody is.
There was peaceful polling in Aceh, a relief to the country's leaders and the international community. Many feared violence would break out during the election, given the tenuous peace between the Indonesian military and the largest political party, Partai Aceh, whose leaders are former separatist rebels. Five former rebels were murdered in the lead-up to the election. Instead, attention turned to several incidents of violence in the remote province of Papua, where voting in some provinces has been delayed due to bad weather. 11 deaths were reported in the province Thursday. Andreas Harsono of Human Rights Watch said native Papuans boycotted what they see as an irrelevant election to push for what they really want, a referendum to vote to separate from Indonesia. He says their stance follows 40 years of human rights abuses under the government's rule.
They boycott the election and the police fear that they might create a bad image of the election and the repression.
Preceding the score of violent incidents on Thursday, three student activists were detained by police, with Human Rights Watch reporting they were denied drinking water and beaten by officers. One student, Yance Mote, is still in detention and charged with treason and incitement, which carries a maximum penalty of life imprisonment, according to Harsono.
Because of the arrest of their leaders and also the torture of the members, some students, about 100 of them, attack a police station in Abipura. But it also increased the police repressions against these students. They were arrested and truck after truck.
Harsono said the violence that occurred in Papua on Thursday should not be seen as an isolated incident.
I think yesterday even only stressed that Indonesian rule is a very repressive one in Papua. The Indonesian government, I think, will keep on saying that this is our country, this is our territory. Meanwhile, the native Papuans will still suffer.
While official results are not released until May 9, the leaders of second-placed Golkar Party and the Indonesian Democratic Party of Struggle were both putting on a brave face, despite what looks like a resounding victory for the president's Democratic Party. Belinda Lopez, FSRN, Jakarta.
President Obama has asked Congress for $83.4 billion for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He says it's his first and last war supplemental, since unlike Bush before him, Obama will be inserting war spending in his regular budget. The request was made against a backdrop of big changes in defense spending, Tanya Snyder reports.
This week, Defense Secretary Robert Gates caused panic among defense contractors with the announcement of his 2010 budget.
We will end production of the F-22 fighter at 187, representing 183 planes in the current program, plus four recommended for inclusion in the FY 2009 supplemental.
U.S. taxpayers have spent $65 billion on the jets to date, and yet the F-22 has never seen combat. The fighter jet was designed for Cold War-style operations and isn't well-suited for unconventional wars like the ones in Iraq and Afghanistan. And they cost $360 million apiece.
For me, it was not a close call.
Gates' decision to cap the F-22s at 187 seems logical enough. But Laura Peterson at Taxpayers for Common Sense says logic might not be the dominant force in this debate.
Members of Congress who want the jobs in their districts and the defense companies, particularly Lockheed Martin, who is the prime contractor and who has spent a lot of money on advertising campaigns, trumpeting the fact that they have thousands of jobs spread around the country. And so therefore, we should keep buying more F-22s for that reason, which we don't think that's a good way to make decisions about defense spending.
Lockheed Martin claims 95,000 jobs would be at stake if the Pentagon stops producing the F-22. Peterson says those numbers seem high, but still, workers from Marietta, Georgia, to Seattle, to St. Louis, to Long Beach could see their jobs on the line. Critics say it makes more sense to create jobs in education and transportation than in defense. And Peterson says a change in spending habits would benefit the military more than anyone.
When you start to fund sort of charity cases within the Pentagon budget, we end up investing money into things that are not necessary for the current threat and our most pressing needs. So that's a huge problem.
Indeed, Gates told reporters that the Air Force had encouraged him to cut the F-22s. Gates's budget included many changes beside the F-22s, including $500 million more than last year for helicopters and increasing personnel by 5%. Winslow Wheeler of the Center for Defense Information says despite the hoopla about cuts, the Pentagon ship is staying on the same course.
He also wants to progress with the F-35 aircraft, which is less expensive than the F-22, but still pretty much unaffordable. It's a huge disappointment in terms of performance. But the real problem right now is that he wants to rush ahead and produce it before it's been tested. That's the kind of decision that gets us into trouble.
Secretary Gates invited Wheeler out to coffee the day after the budget announcement to try to get Wheeler's support for his proposals. Wheeler didn't quite jump on board.
We're very literally getting a smaller, older, less ready to fight military at historically unprecedented high and increasing levels of spending. Secretary Gates's decisions are all budget neutral. The growth of the Pentagon budget is continuing, and he has not changed that.
Members of Congress are rallying to try to save defense jobs in their districts. Before Gates was even finished making his announcement, House Armed Services Committee Chair Ike Skelton had issued a statement declaring that the buck stops with Congress, a reminder to the administration about who makes spending decisions in Washington. And Georgia Senator Saxby Chambliss says he'll work to overturn the secretary's recommendation. He wants the government to buy 60 more F-22s. Otherwise, an estimated 2,000 workers in his state could lose their jobs assembling the planes. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
President Obama announced plans this week to buy more than 17,000 U.S.-made fuel-efficient vehicles for the federal fleet.
Besides a symbolic gesture to both the automotive and environmental communities, Sam Greenspan reports that some groups concerned with mass transit are pleased that the vehicle purchase is moving forward.
The Obama administration says that purchasing fuel-efficient vehicles from American automakers will help stimulate the economy, support the auto industry, and achieve energy efficiency goals. While the federal government is spending millions on fuel-efficient cars, some want more investment in public transportation. Local officials announced this week that the Washington, D.C. Metro will get 20 new cars added to its green and red lines. At Union Station, a metro station near Capitol Hill, Maryland resident Rashina Spears says that the added cars aren't enough.
Oh, no, it's not a fix-all at all. It's not going to be fixed until they revamp the red line. It just needs a lot of work. Usually it's very crowded. It's late. It's just a mess. If they all work well, it'll make a difference. It'll alleviate some of the crowding, but that won't alleviate the problems that they have with cracked rails on the red line, which caused the significant delays.
The addition of 20 subway cars might not seem like much when compared with the federal government's choice of spending $285 million of stimulus funds on vehicles from GM, Ford, and Chrysler. Even though the new cars will be more fuel efficient than the cars they'll be replacing, some are asking if the Obama administration is really committed to changing the nation's transportation infrastructure. And some public interest advocates say he is.
It's a long process transitioning away from a car culture.
Lena Pons is with policy group Public Citizen. She downplayed the actual environmental impact that the purchase could have, but says it is a positive step for the American economy.
And there's, you know, huge infrastructure changes that are involved in sending that message that we're moving away from a car culture. And, I mean, it's certainly such a small number of vehicles in the scheme of the, you know, the total market. It does send a message, you know, to the people of the United States saying, you know, look, we're buying these fuel-efficient vehicles. You know, they're good enough for the government. This is a national effort. This is something that we want to encourage people to do. And so, I mean, in that regard, government purchases of new technologies have always, you know, created markets and created incentives for manufacturers to roll out new technologies. And so the environmental benefits of this particular purchase of vehicles is small, but there are more significant benefits in terms of sending a message of this is a national priority.
And it turns out, mass transit will get a boost too. Ross Capon is with the National Association of Railroad Passengers.
The Obama administration has been very supportive of intercity passenger trains to the extent that we are planning to present a Golden Spike Award to President Obama express our appreciation for his moves in that direction.
Capon says $8 billion of federal funds have been allocated under Obama for the development of intercity rail, up from zero 2 fiscal years ago. Another $1.5 billion, he says, will go towards developing mass transit systems. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sam Greenspan.
The Environmental Protection Agency has announced it will begin to monitor the air quality of 62 schools in 22 states. The program is the first of its kind to assess toxic emissions around schools. But as Africa Jones reports, parents in Berkeley, California say the EPA's action plan won't be enough to protect them and their children from toxic air.
EPA announced the plan after a USA Today report found 435 schools with air quality worse than an Ohio school closed in 2005 for having extremely high levels of carcinogens in the air. Mike Bandrowski is chief of the Air Toxic Radiation and Indoor Air Office at the EPA.
We're concerned about the air quality around schools. The USA Today did a series of articles and testing around schools, and they identified this as a potential issue, and our administrator, Lisa Jackson, agreed that this was an important issue for EPA to address.
But of the 435 schools USA Today examined, only 62 schools in 22 states will be monitored for 2 months. The USA Today report ranked 3 Berkeley schools in the lowest percentile of poor air quality in the nation, but those schools will not be monitored by the EPA. For years, West Berkeley residents have complained that Pacific Steel Casting, the nation's third largest steel foundry, has released high levels of toxic emissions. These include manganese and nickel, 2 metals used in steel production with links to nervous system disorders and cancer. Local environmentalists say the EPA program is a first step, but Berkeley schools need a thorough assessment of its air. Denny Larson is executive director of the Global Community Monitor, a human rights and environmental justice group.
We place schools near industrial zones, near Superfund sites, near known toxic hazards, and we don't protect our children by simply monitoring the air to ensure what they're breathing is safe. We're hoping that in subsequent rounds of monitoring, we can convince EPA to step in. The reason for that is that we have lost all faith in the Bay Area Air Quality Management District.
EPA said one of its reasons it would not monitor Berkeley schools is because the Bay Area Air Quality Management District already does. But that agency's communications director, Lisa Fasano, disputes the findings of the USA Today report and questioned the EPA's response.
If the EPA has decided to move forward with this study to look at air quality around schools, I suspect that is a much more of a political decision than an actual air quality emissions related decision. From the data that we've collected, we don't believe that there is anything suspect with regard to the Pacific Steel factory.
But Denny Larson says the agency has released only some of the data needed to make an assessment.
They won't come clean. I mean, they should be releasing the raw data about what they found in their monitor, and they should be telling the truth about what it says. We need to monitor the air, and if we find that it's not safe for our children to be there, then they need to be moved.
The Bay Area Air Quality Management District says it plans to release comprehensive air monitoring data from around Pacific Steel Casting in the next 2 weeks. EPA says it may monitor more schools, including Berkeley schools, in the future. Africa Jones, FSRN.
And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Summitry and punditry. Amidst pomp, circumstance, and protests, 20 world leaders gathered in London recently for what was essentially a mass photo op. Billed as G20, the gathering of 20 leading and developing economies, it seemed more like a gathering of the blind, groping for light. The great Nigerian playwright, Wole Soyinka, in his biting poetic critique of African military dictatorships, the apotheosis of Master Sergeant Doe, writes, "But crowns are crowns. When rulers meet, their embraces are of presence. Absent cries make empty phrases." That poem leapt to mind when images were flashed of politicians wearing cheesy smiles, embracing each other amidst the pops and flashes of photographers. For hugs and smiles amongst politicians do not policy make. Nations act through their own interests, period. If that means hamming it up for photo ops, so be it. If that means grimacing across shiny wooden tables, so be it. A year ago, at a similar economic summit in Davos, Switzerland, then U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice told the delegates, "The U.S. economy is resilient, its structure is sound, and its long-term economic fundamentals are healthy." That wasn't true then, and it ain't true now. The truth is, the U.S. and the global economic system was built and maintained on systemic injustice, I speak of African slavery, and profound exploitation of workers worldwide and at home. The truth is, this is a crisis endemic to capitalism, where markets swallow markets and wealth is made by con games that would make the mafia blush, but the biggest banks on earth. The latest economic summit was PR amidst chaos. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN. From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.